political commentator and investigative journalist. You're with Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world, and welcome to the Patrick Henningsen Show here on today's News Talk TNT with me, Basil Valentine, sitting in for Patrick today, Tuesday, the 30th of April, 2024. Summer is almost upon us, but you'd hardly know it here in the United Kingdom. We haven't seen the sun at all. Someone who's always sunny is my first guest, the inestimable Roger Stone, author of The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ, Stone's Rules, How to Win at Politics, Business and Style, and Tricky Dicky, The Rise and Fall of Richard M. Nixon. In the second hour tonight, I'm going to be joined once again by Dr. Frank Romano, who is still in Istanbul, of course, hoping to sail with the Freedom Flotilla imminently. And also today, I've got Blake Lovewell joining me from sunny England, talking about the latest in Yemen and the raising of the temperature and increased hostilities there. But for now, I'm going to do a quick pivot to our old friend Rudy Giuliani, who posted on X this morning, "The 2020 US presidential election was stolen. The only reason we can't bring the truth to light is because of the sheer breadth and depth of the corruption." Giuliani, of course, is facing charges himself. It seems that what he said there could bring him into further trouble with the law. Who knew it in the United States of America? Questioning the result of an election looks like it is increasingly going to become illegal. Meanwhile, Joe Biden is underwater in the polls. There's no way, according to all these statistical analysis, he could recover from where he is at the moment, which is trailing Biden, trailing Trump, sorry, by 49 to 43 in a matchup with 8% unsure. 49 Trump, 43 Biden, 8% unsure. Now, that is too big a gap to make up, barring some sort of miracle, between now and November. So what are the Democrats going to do? Ditch Kamala Harris? Ditch Joe Biden himself? All that talk seems to have gone away. There was quite a lot of money, believe it or not, for Michelle Obama to be the nominee. Bookmakers scurrying for cover. She was backed all the way in from 100 to 1 down to 20 to 1 to be the Democratic nominee. That's all gone quiet. It seems like Biden is going to run again, but he's going to struggle with numbers like that. I can't wait to talk to Roger about The Man Who Killed Kennedy, LBJ, vice president, of course, who was sort of forced on the ticket, really. Kennedy didn't want him as his running mate, but was forced to accept him in a deal at the convention. And we all know how that ended just a couple of years later. Okay, great. Roger, are you with me? Can you hear me now?
I'm indeed. I'm a victim of my own technological limitations. I apologize.
Don't worry. We all are at times. That's the world we live in. I was just actually, I've got the cover of your book up, The Man Who Killed Kennedy, LBJ, and juxtaposing it with a tweet this morning from Rudy Giuliani, who said the 2020 US presidential election was stolen. The only reason we can't bring the truth to light is because of the sheer breadth and depth of the corruption. There are parallels here, aren't there, Roger? The breadth and depth of the corruption surrounding the assassination of John F. Kennedy and the similar shenanigans with the 2020 presidential election.
Well, I really believe that John F. Kennedy, and this, look, I'm a Nixon man, but in retrospect, he was an ardent, strong anti-communist. He favored a deep tax cut. He favored a massive defense buildup. He favored a silver-backed dollar over the objections of the banking interests. He wanted higher taxes on oil billionaires. He had a deep distrust of the intelligence services because they had lied to him about the Bay of Pigs. They had lied to him about in the Cuban Missile Crisis. He was an outsider. I think that ultimately he was taken out by the same exact deep state. Eisenhower, of course, called them the military-industrial complex that would go on to remove Richard Nixon in a silent coup, mostly by manipulation of the CIA, attempt to assassinate Ronald Reagan, then attempt to remove Ronald Reagan in Iran-Contra, fail, and then, of course, later to invent the Russian collusion hoax and the Ukraine hoax. And the January 6th hoax. That is, I think, a straight line of history.
I can't disagree with you. I must admit, the latest polls are showing Biden, frankly, underwater. His success rate is at 39%, with 61 saying his presidency is a failure. Donald Trump, on the other hand, 55% of American voters, this is according to a CNN poll, say his presidency was a success, but only 44% say it was a failure. This is a big disparity and too big for Biden to make up by November, absent some further misdeeds, shall we say, Roger?
Which is why they, of course, don't want this to be about Joe Biden. They don't want it to be about the Biden record, whether it's gasoline prices or the inflation index or the billions that they're shipping abroad to Ukraine, or about their open border policies and what that has cost America in terms of the drug epidemic, the crime epidemic, the fiscal hemorrhaging of cities and counties who have to pay for social services for illegals, even if it means cutting services on U.S. citizens, sanitation, education, law enforcement. So the impact of those policies combined with Biden's inability to perform as a candidate, he is obviously not all there, even in his best performances. And then you add that to the burgeoning scandal that is proven by the Biden crime family, his son, his brother, other members of his family. He's in a very tough position for reelection. Democrats, both professional Democrats inside the system, and I think average Democrats would prefer to have a different Democratic nominee, yet they have rigged the nomination process, which a sitting president can do, so that he's had no real opposition and that the rules have been rigged for his renomination, regardless of how non-functional he is as a candidate.
There was a lot of talk, and I seem to remember you perhaps saying it first, Roger, that Michelle Obama might be parachuted in at the convention. It's all gone quiet again. There was actually a lot of money for it in the English betting markets where we're allowed to bet on these things. She shortened right up. It looks unlikely now that she's going to be the nominee, although they could, of course, still go for some sort of, jamboree type event at the convention with, Biden gracefully stepping aside and a coronation of sorts in a bid to completely re-energize the party, press the restart button effectively. But I think more likely, surely, knowing that Biden can't possibly make it through another 4 years, there can't be that much amphetamine sulfate in the world, is there, to keep him animated for another 4 years, they're likely to ditch Kamala Harris and replace her so that they've got a smoother succession. Do you think that's where the smart money might be going now, Roger?
Well, unfortunately, here's how I think it could work. And that is Biden announces just shortly before the convention that for reasons of health, he's not going to run again. He has no intention of resigning. He's going to see the job through. But the rigors of a campaign and governing are more than he believes he can do. So he's selfishly going to step aside and finish the job of building back better, and then legally release his delegates at the convention. I do think, left to their own will, the candidate they would seek to draft would be Michelle Obama. She's the most popular woman in the country. She's among certainly most popular woman Democrat in the country. She can command millions of dollars like that. I've never said she was going to run for president. What I said was she was likely to end up as the nominee. They will, of course, they being the Democrat Party leaders, and other special interests, will say to her, you're the one person who might be able to beat Donald Trump, and she could end up as the candidate. Yes, I still think that's entirely possible.
Chair, I weren't aware of the fact you'd written this smashing-looking tome, Stone's Rules, How to Win at Politics, Business, and Style. But it strikes me from all the way over the other side of the pond here in the United Kingdom, that the US really has lost its way, not just in the last few years under Biden, but really a decline that goes all the way back, frankly, to the death of John Kennedy. Looking at the streets filled with zombies, the decline of manufacturing, the overall deterioration, should we say, of public standards and of infrastructure means that the United States is it's no longer quite the shining beacon of industry and deportment as well, Roger, something that people often forget these days. You know, people don't seem to know how to conduct themselves anymore, do they?
No, look, it's quite extraordinary. In the last month, when I have been out with my wife for dinner in public locations, in public restaurants, I was accosted with various degrees of physical menacing and obscenity by people who evidently did not like my politics. This kind of civility, particularly when you're having a family dinner with your children and your grandchildren, you don't want to be called a Russian traitor, which I am, of course, not and not convicted of. There is no civility. And I find as Trump is in the media more and more, these insane attacks on me in public that are largely verbal, sometimes physical, just really ramp up extraordinarily. These people have no, there's no decorum, there's no line under which they, no line that they will not cross. It's very sick.
Indeed it is. Trump ran last time on a platform of peace and prosperity, which one would have thought was the minimum requirement for any presidential candidate of sane and lucid disposition. But it seems that a lot of people in Washington want war and austerity for their own population, as well as the rest of the world, particularly, of course, on the Eastern Front. There was an article in Foreign Affairs talking about how Europe, but perhaps not the United States, should go to war with Russia, and even people talking about winnable nuclear wars and other such nonsense. Again, what has infected the minds of permanent Washington that the progress made over the last decades of the 20th century under Nixon, originally with detente, and then subsequently the breakthrough with Reagan, Gorbachev, and all the rest of it, all that's been flushed down the toilet in favor of some new, entirely confected enmity. That's the point, Roger. It's all entirely synthetic, all this aggro.
Well, first of all, I think that Trump is in the tradition of both Eisenhower and Reagan of peace through strength. In other words, that you kept your military might, your overwhelming power, but used it as a deterrent to war, not using it to go around the world looking for conflicts to get into where your inherent national interests were not clear. This is the so-called neocon Bush New World Order foreign policy. And Trump is in that other tradition, the tradition of Eisenhower, the tradition of Goldwater, the tradition of Reagan, that strength is, you know, peace through strength. Quite simply, it's a huge foreign policy difference than what we see today, which is where the Uniparty is back in control, and we're on the cusp of war in the Middle East, and on the cusp of war in the China, Ukrainian conflict.
But nevertheless, you agree, because I can't help thinking that the standards of diplomacy have deteriorated in the last 30 years. The quality of conversation around international disputes is now such that if you attempt to talk to your enemy, immediately absurd comparisons with the 1930s are brought out, and whoever it is you're talking to is likened to Hitler, and any attempt at reaching a diplomatic solution is automatically called appeasement. Donald Trump is a deal maker, and if we are to have a peace and prosperous world, Roger, then we need to make deals all around the world, don't we?
I could not agree more. When Trump first became president, in all of the briefings, even among the former presidents, they said your biggest single problem is this lunatic in North Korea, this little dictator. We think he has, or he's close to having, a nuclear capability. I think he's your number one problem. And Trump says, well, what is he saying? And they said, well, we don't know what he's saying. He's not talking to us. And Trump said, well, don't you think it would be smart for maybe somebody to talk to him and see what he wants, or try to get some reading on what he's doing? It's common sense. And of course, they said when Trump was elected, he was going to cause a nuclear war with North Korea. Yet he's the guy who got the dictator to the table, and they at least temporarily halted their nuclear weapons development program, at least temporarily, until, of course, there was a change of presidencies. So it's extraordinary what you can do with old-fashioned diplomacy. They don't practice it in Washington anymore.
Yes, that really is particularly disappointing for those of us sort of sitting in the middle, as it were. The legal attempts to derail the Trump campaign remind me of Jonathan Swift's famous Gulliver's Travels, where he was tied down. The Lilliputians tried to tie him down, this huge giant, to them with lots of little ropes. And of course, it didn't work. Do you think the, lawfare, really, the political prosecution in the courts of Donald Trump is going to significantly affect the campaign this summer, or is he going to be able to shake it all off just as Gulliver did?
Well, it's counterintuitive already based on what we've seen. Normally, when a candidate gets charged with multiple crimes, their funding dries up, their voter support dries up, and so on. This tsunami of lawfare, all of these prosecutions of Donald Trump, both civilly and criminally, are so obviously timed and so carefully coordinated by the same group of players that it becomes abundantly clear that it is literally just election interference. Now, the scheduling hasn't gone as his tormentors had hoped. I'm not an attorney, but I'm told that now, because of due process in the Supreme Court, makes it much, much less likely that special counsel could get to a federal trial before Election Day, either in the so-called documents case or in the Washington, D.C. case. I'm not certain of that, but that's the conventional wisdom. And therefore, Trump is subjected to it's very hard to describe, this confection, this fabrication, this pasted together prosecution in New York City, where they really don't have a crime, where federal prosecutors and the Federal Election Committee both thoroughly investigated all these transactions and couldn't find any crime. This is at best a business records civil case, but they have jacked it to be a felony because they need a conviction, a felony conviction in a criminal case against Donald Trump before the election to siphon his funds for lawyers, to siphon his energy, having to sit in a courtroom for weeks at a time, and then potentially even be incarcerated. And it is on charges that are really not there. I mean, excellent interview between criminal defense attorney David Schoen on just the other night with Mark Levin, that I highly recommend making this very case. That there is no case, and this judge who gave a campaign contribution to Biden and whose daughter directly benefits as a Democratic fundraising consultant from this trial, which she uses as the centerpiece of her fundraising, $93 million worth of it, he has a direct financial conflict. He should step aside, but there is no chance that he will do so.
No chance there. But what chance of Rudy Giuliani and the other lawyers in Arizona being convicted there? Rudy tweeted out this morning, in defiant mood, the 2020 U.S. presidential election was stolen. The only reason we can't bring the truth to light, and so on. What chances are there for a genuine election this time round? I mean, this is going to be the biggest fight of all time, isn't it? On the ground, on the day. The most scrutinized election in American history.
I guess what I would do if I were Rudy Giuliani's lawyers is I would go and take every word that was filed by Carrie Lake and others with the U.S. Supreme Court documenting election fraud and worse. I would paste it into a motion to dismiss and I would file it with the court in Arizona. Now, I'm not a lawyer, and therefore, I'm not trying to give anyone legal advice, but I think if I were him, that's what I'd direct my lawyer to do.
Finally, Roger, unfortunately, because we're out of time, we like a little flutter over here on this side of the pond on politics, believe it or not. Donald Trump's running mate, you're an insider. All sorts of people, Nikki Haley, Tulsi Gabbard, Ben Carson. Where's the smart money going inside the Beltway, Roger?
Look, I don't think there is a short list. It will most certainly not be Nikki Haley. I think the days of ticket balancing are over. I think the president has no intention going there. He seems to be in no hurry. We hear a lot of good names. Elise Stefanik from upstate New York is mentioned. Tulsi Gabbard, the former Democrat, now an independent, is mentioned. You hear Devin Nunes, the former chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, now with Truth Social, being mentioned. You have Senator J.D. Vance being mentioned. I can't read the tea leaves. Here's what I'll say. First of all, politically, you have to choose someone who the American people will see as qualified, experienced, with the temperament and judgment record to say, yes, this person could, under the worst circumstances, become president. Then politically, you need someone who is sure-footed, someone who's not going to make mistakes, someone who can handle themselves with the media and with the public. Thirdly, you want someone, obviously, completely understands this is a supporting role. This is a second banana role who won't ever upstage the president, particularly this president who likes to set his own tone. And then lastly, someone who is, should the worst happen, completely committed to the anti-establishment America First agenda, not a neocon, not an establishment Republican. Nixon used to say to me, and said to me directly, when looking for a running mate, don't look for someone who can help you. There is no one who can help you. Just choose someone who doesn't hurt you. Well, that may be a bit cynical, but it'd be hard to look at recent history and see an example of where the vice presidential candidate had actually mattered.
It's a very good point. Thank you so much for joining us tonight on today's News Talk, Roger Stone. It's been a real treat to have you.
Great to be here. God bless you.
Thank you. There he goes. That's Roger Stone. We're going to take a short break with the network now. And when we come back, I'll be joined by Blake Lovewell, who's been doing a deep dive into Yemen and what we can expect in terms of the conflict there with the international shipping. We'll be right back after this short break.
TNT's Lembit Open.
I am always disappointed when I see civil servants, and he was a civil servant, he wasn't elected, preaching to the elected representatives of this country about what they should and shouldn't be doing. I wonder what his next job's going to be. Will it be in the green movement or somewhere else? Fundamentally, my issue is that Chris Stark assumes that everybody agrees that there is a climate emergency. And even more strangely, he thinks it's good for the British economy for us to invest in stopping this climate emergency.
Limit. OPEC. And today's News Talk, TNT.
In a democracy, the majority vote rules. But in most democracies, you can only vote for change every 3 or 4 years. To understand what people want, governments and political parties use focus groups. These focus groups can include as little as 20 people. Australia is a country of over 25 million people. Does making decisions based on 20 people sound fair to you? Have your say. Be heard in between elections. Download the For My Say app now. That is number 4, My Say.
On air 24/7. This is today's News Talk TNT.
And welcome back to the Patrick Henningsen Show with me, Basil Valentine, sitting in for Patrick today, Tuesday, the 30th of April, 2024. The Yemeni Houthis have attacked Greek and American shipping, according to CENTCOM, and they will continue to carry out their military operations until Israel stops its attacks on Gaza. The Iran-backed Houthi militants, according to Gulf News, have launched fresh attacks on Red Sea shipping, including Greek commercial vessels, U.S. military and maritime agencies have said, continuing a recent resurgence in strikes along the vital route. Joining me to discuss this now is TNT contributor and investigative journalist Blake Lovewell. Welcome to the program, Blake.
Hey, thanks. Great to be with you. Once again, hope everyone out there is doing well. Got a little update on Yemen because as Yemen often does make waves in the mainstream media, it broke into our consciousness in 2014 with the conflict with Saudi Arabia, and then slowly faded. And then there was a resurgence a few years later when certain NGOs were raising awareness about humanitarian crisis, the outbreak of cholera, dysentery, and other such, long extinct diseases in the West that were resurging in Yemen, having had many years of destructive activity by Saudi Arabia and allies, including the UK, US, Israel, and so on. And then once again, Yemen faded from the news. Then in the wake of the conflict escalating in Israel and Gaza, Yemen made a resurgence, taking a hero/martyr role in support of Iran. And I'm not saying that Yemen is one block of people that agree on everything, because there are many conflicting groups. The current ordained leadership is Western-backed and supported. The oft-referred-to Houthis, which is kind of a slang name for the Ansar Allah movement, they are kind of the... probably the most popular and powerful group. And, you know, if history looks back kindly on them, they'll be the rightful claimants to power in Yemen. But there are other groups active as well. There are groups under the affiliated banner of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, yet another branch on that sickly tree, sickly US-sponsored tree. Al-Qaeda formed from the Mujahideen by the influential hands of the CIA molded in an image that's useful for the US to have an enemy. So there's various different groups, and another large group is the Southern Transitional Council. They're the UAE's backed extremist militant group in Yemen. So it's a very mixed picture. But yes, Yemen made headlines once again in the last 5 months, where when the Ansar Allah movement, the Houthi group, began attacking ships in the that were passing by Yemen. Yemen is strategically placed on the Bab el Mandeb Strait, which joins the Arabian Sea to the Red Sea to the Indian Ocean, which is one of the main shipping lanes. It's kind of the gateway from the south towards the Suez Canal. And so most shipping for at least Europe, destined for Holland and Europe, goes through there. And it's kind of quite a pivotal bottleneck. The Ansar Allah movement has proven how vital of a bottleneck it is by lobbing low-cost missiles, drones, and whatever it seems to be able to get its hands on at various shipping affiliated with Israel. Now, this is not a mere tantrum. This is an active, targeted policy by the Ansar Allah movement to harass any ally of Israel. And it's having a massive effect. Maersk, one of the biggest shipping operators in the world, have said they will not be shipping through the strait. They will be sending everything round the south of South Africa, adding 10 days to a 30-day trip, which adds massive costs in fuel, massive delays in time. But not only Maersk, it seems lots of other operators are very scared to send ships through. Iranian ships, ships who are friendly to Iran seem to be able to get an easy ride. Chinese ships are reportedly able to get through unharassed, and Iran does escort the odd ship through that it wants to make sure is safe. However, ships that are either destined to dock with any port in Israel or have departed from any port in Israel are pretty much sure fire targets for the Ansar Allah movement. And despite there being a cessation over the last month of attacks, they've renewed with increased fervor their attacks on shipping, having taken their first fatalities in an attack which killed three crew aboard a shipping liner in the strait. Which is kind of a good statistic for them, because they managed to harass a lot of ships without causing any deaths. But, you know, any deaths are unfortunate and will come to the counter operative deaths on the Yemeni side shortly on in our discussion. But what I think is salient in the last week in the various tidbits of news that we can gather out of the Yemeni region is that the US lost another MQ-9 Reaper drone over Yemen. Now, these are the drones that you will probably recognize from media reports. They're the one with the kind of big pointy tail and the bulbous head. They're the $30 million drones that stalk the skies above the Middle East, picking out targets, dropping expensive warheads on innocent civilians. The US has lost a third MQ-9 Reaper drone over Yemen, which was shot down by Ansar Allah troops and has been confirmed. I mean, as much as America can confirm that they're losing a war against a ragtag bunch of rebels in the Middle East once again, the statement goes, The U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Byron J. McGarry, a Defense Department spokesman, acknowledged to the AP, the Associated Press, on Saturday that a U.S. Air Force MQ-9 drone crashed in Yemen. He said an investigation was underway without elaborating. But as you may see shortly, it's fairly well proven that Ansar Allah have the capability to take these drones down and are happy to evidence these things on social media. So as much as the US would like to keep that genie in the bottle, that they are losing the fight to David, the Goliath of the US imperial war machine is taking another bloody blow from the Ansar Allah movement.
Yes, within Yemen itself, of course, Ansar Allah are not the sole government, are they? They don't control the whole of the territory of Yemen. Am I right? Is there some sort of uneasy peace and they've got one corner which enables them to attack the shipping?
Exactly, yes. And they're on that western side of Yemen, having been sort of progressively forced out. I would say the largest enemy, you know, the largest predator on the Ansar Allah movement is the Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is a bit of an umbrella term for various groups that the West or the CIA or whoever you wish to blame for creating Al-Qaeda. They sponsor and foster these various groups. But as I say, there's also the Southern Transitional Council, and they're probably one of the largest controllers of the southern region. So yeah, as you say, that Ansar Allah movement is by no means hegemonic in Yemen. There's various different levels of conflict, and there's still the official Yemeni government and Yemeni military, who are kind of softly backed by Western states and whoever wishes to, you know, diminish the Ansar Allah movement. But they're much more of a placeholder because they weren't the Ansar Allah movement under Houthi originally weren't ever allowed to compete in fair elections. Otherwise, they probably would have gained a legitimate stance. And as yet, they remain in the kind of shadows in the illegitimacy. And yet they have this outsized military capability. Definitely, right. There is some help from Iran on that front. But there's also definitely some of the spirit of rebellion and, you know, underdog spirit that allows people to, you know, necessity being the mother of invention, it allows people to do extraordinary things. And so we see this tiny group on the tip of a peninsula of the Arabian Peninsula able to lob stones, or more accurately drones, at US warships, something that would be unthinkable for even China or Russia or one of the bigger powers in the world. They wouldn't dare poke the beast directly, yet this small group is doing what I think many in the world would say is a just act when compared to the various regime change wars that the US has perpetrated, as well as the genocide it supports in Israel.
Well, there's a sort of uneasy truce at the moment then between Ansar Allah, aka the Houthis, and the government of Rashid Mohammed al-Alimi in Sana'a, the capital, with a no man's land in between. What's the situation on the ground?
On the ground, I think it's a lot more confusing than it would be allowed to appear. Yes, there are these truces which seem to come and go, and you know, you can only trust your enemy so far. As well as this, the Western influence is massive, because the UK, the US, and other allies have been doing direct strikes on Yemen against Ansar Allah targets. And so it's not really the Yemeni government that's deciding on the borders. It's the US, the UK, and allies, including France. Notably, well, you know, these strikes have been huge. The US has used about $1 billion of munitions in the last few months on Yemen, $1 billion, which is a huge amount. And there'll be other amounts of UK weapons and so on and so forth. You know, UK jets being flown out of Cyprus doing strikes down in Yemen. And these don't always get counted and recorded. But so there's a huge amount of interference from the outside. Yemen is much more square on the grand chessboard than you know, in control of its own destiny. But it's quite a unique situation because the US has not declared war on Yemen. In fact, Biden moved the Ansar Allah movement off the designated terrorist list for a few years when I think they were trying to do some geopolitical maneuvering. And yeah, then in the last year has put them back onto the designated terrorist list. But there's not an official war on Yemen. So there's only there's a limit to how much the US, the UK and their allies can bomb innocent civilians in Yemen. Apparently there's a limit on that because technically this is a defensive act. They're trying to strike those drone bases or whatever they deem as a potential threat to the shipping. So all of those operations have to be taken place under that umbrella. And notably, the EU didn't go along with the US plan. They have done their own naval mission in the Red Sea, launching that in mid-February, which to me points to a bit of a division within NATO. Whilst we see this kind of NATO unity in Ukraine pushing for more and more war under this, you know, transnational NATO aegis and expansion with Turkey, Sweden, that whole narrative, then in Yemen, there's something much more different going on. And, you know, big European countries like Spain have decided to not take part in it. And I think that's possibly to do with the overarching theme of Israel, that the Ansar Allah movement in Yemen are anti-Israel. And so to be, you know, if supportive of the Gazans, you kind of support the Yemenis tacitly. And so there's all these different threads being drawn in, which is why I think the Yemen situation is so important. And, you know, why we shouldn't just let it fade from our minds just because it's out of the headlines for a week or two, because so much is going on right now there.
American officials have speculated that the rebels may be running out of weapons as a result of the American campaign against them and firing drones and missiles steadily for months. But on the X platform just today, we saw the result of their latest action, as we can see now in this clip. Yeah.
Ya Allah, sidi ya Allah. Allahu Akbar, al-maut l'Amerika, al-maut l'Israel, al-la'nat al-Yahud.
They're
certainly not running out of artillery there, Blake.
No, and I mean, I often think of the quote, rumors of the death of X, Y, or Z are very much overstated. I don't think that the Ansar Allah movement are going anywhere soon. And they've proven that even with the merest resources, the meekest resources, they're able to mount an offensive strike on the US. And just to clarify, that video showed a missile being launched by the Ansar Allah movement from the ground and striking and destroying the $90 million US MQ-9 Reaper drone, the third one of recent months destroyed. And that's filmed and proven and shown on you know, social media, which means that the US cannot hide that. And as I said earlier, it's a David versus Goliath, Lilliputian effort, yet it's having an outsized asymmetric victory. And we would do well to remember that, you know, when you see a video of some guy shouting Allahu Akbar, death to Israel, death to America, as is pretty much the slogan of the Ansar Allah movement, but that there are good reasons for that. You know, there's vindication for that action and for that sentiment. In Yemen, there is a ongoing humanitarian crisis, and there has been for over a decade now, since Saudi Arabia launched its offensive war on the people of Yemen. 40% of children are not in school, as well as 17 million people in Yemen need urgent health assistance that they cannot get. A few years ago, we had this kind of a hubbub in the press about the Yemen crisis and fundraising. And I believe Oxfam were doing a large-scale fundraising there for Yemen. But Yemen was being destroyed by Saudi Arabia, which is a massive UK affiliate. And so you can only go so far in helping Yemen. And that's kind of borne out by the fact that the WHO, everybody's favorite transnational health institution, have halved their funding for Yemen since 2019, since Saudi Arabia started. The Yemeni forces started coming out against Israel. And furthermore, in December this year, when when Ansar Allah started striking ships in support of the Gaza-Palestine side in the Israel-Gaza conflict, and the World Food Programme has suspended food distribution. They claim it's because they can't get political agreement on the ground. And that may be so. There may be such violent or tempestuous conditions that it's hard to distribute food, but it's also easy to see that there's political pressure from certain arenas to not help on the ground until those people have given up their recalcitrant views against the West.
So remind us, for the sake of our viewers, what is the Saudi Yemen war all about, and are the Saudis targeting both the Sanaa government and the Houthis, or just one side? Is it a three-way go? And what started it?
It's like an age-old tribal conflict, I would say, going back into the history books. But Yemen was rather obsequient to Saudi Arabia, its neighbor to the north, for a good while. But then the Houthi movement arose because it was, I would say, in response to Al-Qaeda's presence. And when I say Al-Qaeda, I also align them with the US, because, historically it has been the US and the intelligence apparatus behind it that have forwarded Al-Qaeda into ISIS and so on. And so the presence of Al-Qaeda in Yemen in the, mid-noughties onwards meant a deterioration of conditions in Yemen. And then I would say the Houthi movement came as sort of a natural backlash against that, quite a populist type of thing, where they would kind of defeat the Al-Qaeda militants who were kind of harassing people and offer some safety and stability. The national government of Yemen were not able to do so, perhaps because they were hobbled or kneecapped by other international powers that be. But the Saudi arm came in extremely strongly down on the Yemens from 2014 onwards, which was very unpopular internationally, even though it has support of its long-term friends, the US and the UK. It still drew a lot of international ire, and I think definitely diminished the Saudi view, the view of Saudi Arabia as sort of not a neutral player in the Middle East, but at least a diplomatic, observer. And then they were, partaking in a lot of war crimes against the Ansar Allah movement, or the kind of Houthi the Houthi groups that follow the kind of ideology of al-Houthi, the original leader who is now long dead, which is why it's not officially called the Houthi movement anymore. That was 15 years ago that was being established, and so to continue to use the terminology Houthi is a bit contentious. It's definitely done in the West in what I would call propaganda, to diminish the group as a sort of ideological vagary a kind of rogue group, when actually they're probably the kind of populist reaction to Western imperial intervention in their state, as is a tale as old as time, or at least as old as the last 200 years of Western imperialism.
And of course, the Houthis, Ansar Allah, not being allied or in receipt of any financial assistance from the West, I suppose that's why, uniquely among Arab nations, they are prepared to take up arms on the Palestinians' behalf, whereas Saudi, Egypt, the Gulf states, everybody else sits on their hands.
Yeah, exactly. They are not alone. They are, we should make bear no bones, the Ansar Allah movement is backed by Iran. And as we are seeing the dice fall, we're seeing this dichotomy. So if you're falling on the Iranian side, that's the kind of pan-Arabic movement of old has kind of fallen under Iran's aegis. And then you've got Israel at the forefront of the kind of Western imperial US group. And then, yeah, as you say, Egypt, Turkey, various other states are kind of in the middle ground, having to choose between the lesser or greater of two evils. It's a very difficult place for them to be. I wouldn't want to be them either, because as we're seeing, you know, the ascendance of Russia, the ascendance of China, the descendants of America, you've got to really choose your side carefully.
Newsweek reports that the Houthis are ready to play their part in a total Iran v Israel war. Meanwhile, Iran says economic talks with Saudi Arabia have been constructive, stressing developing science and technical cooperation. So perhaps indeed, Iran could act, as the bridge between Saudi and the Houthis.
Yeah, we can only hope for peace in the Middle East in our time. And if Iran can broker that, I'm all for it.
Thank you, Blake Lovewell. We're going to take a break for the headlines now. When we come back, Frank Romano, direct from Istanbul. Don't go away.